Well, folks, I believe our time has come. Hello to everyone, and welcome to the spectacularly exciting teleclass, Influenza, People, Poultry, and Pets, with the spectacularly exciting Dr. Corey Brown. My name is Paul Weber, and this is a Weber training teleclass, but don't let that fool you. Most of the heavy lifting for this lecture series is done by a fantastic group of volunteers in North America and South America, the South Pacific, UK, Europe, the Middle East, thanks to all of them. And thanks to Dr. Corey Brown for joining us again this year to bring another teleclass lecture on zoonotic infections. Dr. Brown is a professor in the Department of Veterinary Pathology at the University of Georgia. She's the recipient of the Josiah Meigs Distinguished Teaching Professor Award, and a very well-deserved award that was. She's an advisor to the Food and Drug Administration and the CDC. She is a consultant on animal health development in Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, and the Republic of Georgia. She's the editor of Foreign Animal Diseases Journal, and she is the coordinator for international activities for her university department. To say the least, she is an amazing woman, and she is here from Athens, Georgia, to bring us the teleclass, Influenza, People, Poultry, and Pets. It's my honor to welcome Dr. Corey Brown.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much, and what a lovely introduction. I'm honored and flattered and just delightful to be talking to everyone today about this disease du jour, which is avian influenza. What we're going to do over the next 30 to 40 minutes is review some of the basics about the disease. We're going to do a synthesis of the disease and look across species lines so that perhaps we can better interpret the articles that we read in the media. I think that avian influenza, this H5N1, might be the very best example of comparative medicine and of the blurring line between human and animal medicine. So let's go to the first slide of the conference, which has the title Influenza Viruses at the top. I'm going to take you back to Virology 101, which many of you, I know all of you have had, but some of it's probably been many years ago. I know it's true for me. The influenza viruses are all part of the family Orthomyxoviridae, and there are three types, A, B, and C. And these viruses are classed in the A, B, or C categories depending upon their nucleoprotein and matrix antigens. Humans get all three types, A, B, and C. Type A are the ones we worry about the most, and type A occurs in humans. This is the majority of the cases of influenza in humans, but also occurs in the other species listed. We're going to focus today on the disease in humans, birds, and pigs. Although we know that horses and seals can be infected with avian influenza, and we have seen outbreaks in those species, we haven't seen the extensive cross-species transfer that we have had with the avian viruses. Although there is one exception. Within this last year, an equine influenza virus started infecting dogs, and we've seen problems, especially at greyhound racetracks, where this new virus has moved among dogs, but there have been no human cases. Now, what I want you to look at in that third bullet item of the species that type A occurs in, you don't see cats or dogs there. This avian influenza virus has now crossed over into some cats and just a couple of dogs. So we'll come back to that. On to the next slide, which is about type A influenzas. There's a big picture of the virus there, with the two main proteins by which the type A influenza is classified. So there are 16 different kinds of antigenic hemagglutinin molecules and 9 different types of neuraminidase molecules. Every influenza virus has one kind of hemagglutinin and one kind of neuraminidase. That hemagglutinin molecule is what binds to the surface of the cell. And then the neuraminidase is what's responsible for the virus getting out of the cell. So there are 16 different hemagglutinin types. All of the human influenzas are either 1, 2, or 3 of the hemagglutinins. and all of the bad bird viruses are H5 and H7. So you've probably seen designations of influenza viruses, and it's always H a number, N a number. Well, it's based on the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase types. But if you just remember for now that all the human influenzas are 1, 2, and 3, and all the bad bird viruses are H5 and H7. And if we go to the next slide, which is titled Type A Influenza in Humans, the flu gets in. You look at the picture on the right, the flu gets in and binds to cells in the respiratory tract. So at first you have some respiratory difficulty, but after a little while the virus then goes out into the circulation, and that's when you really feel the flu-like syndrome. But the virus can replicate in these cells in the respiratory tract because the hemagglutinin of the human virus, the 1, 2, and 3 viruses, binds to a specific receptor that humans have in their respiratory tract, the upper respiratory tract. And this is a sialic acid. It's a carbohydrate receptor. And so that hemagglutinin 1, 2, or 3 will bind to that sialic acid, specifically the sialic acid that's linked to galactose by alpha-2-6. So if you just remember alpha-2-6, human respiratory tract, upper respiratory system. So that's how it gets in, and it's how it gets out. So it helps to explain why the flu is so contagious. Anytime you have a virus that's replicating in the upper respiratory tract, and we're all breathing in air from people around us, and when we exhale, the viruses can come out the same way. So that explains the contagious nature of the H1-2-3 viruses, the influenza A viruses in people. We get influenza in the U.S. every year. It tends to be a seasonal occurrence. And if you look at this graph, which is the next slide, type A influenza in humans, it's estimated that as many as 50,000 people die every year from influenza. Many of these are the elderly. And about 5 to 10% of people who go into the hospital with influenza will die. Most of these influenzas are A, as you can see from the graph. So we have seasonal peaks, and then in that graph, you can see the red, the blue, and the yellow are all type A. And it's predominantly, what we're seeing in the last couple of years is predominantly H3N2, and then we don't know what the other is because some labs only type the A. But that H1N1 really isn't seen much anymore. Last time we saw that was 2002-2003. So that's just a very short picture of regular human influenza, type A. Now let's go on to swine, which is the next slide, type A influenza in swine. This is something that every vet student learns about. Swine influenza is fairly common in swine herds. And the types that we see in pigs are listed there. H1N1, H3N2, and H1N2. And this is important strictly because of the economy. You can see the pig there on the left. When pigs get this virus, if they don't die, as the pig on the right did with all of this swelling and edema and hemorrhage in the lung, if they don't die from it, they have a permanently reduced respiratory capacity, and they're always scrawny. So most good swine operations try to keep swine influenza out. The H1N1, we know that that's been present in our pigs for, well, probably 80 years. And we actually think that this H1N1 is a variant of the pandemic influenza that hit people in 1918. And we'll come back to that. H1N2 is something we've seen in pigs only in the last 10 years, and we think that derived from the H1N1, that there was an antigenic drift, and now we have H1N2. Okay, why are pigs important about influenza? Well, pigs in their respiratory tract, in their upper respiratory tract, specifically the trachea, they have this same receptor that human influenza will bind to, that alpha-2-6 linkage. But they also have an alpha-2-3 linkage. That's the receptor that avian viruses bind to. So we always thought, well, when the avian virus is mixed with a pig virus, then something comes out that can infect humans. We don't think that anymore, and we will go over that in just a minute. So that's the disease in pigs. It's fairly prevalent. Then the next slide, with all the pretty colored chickens in the corner, we'll talk about influenza in birds, type A influenza in birds. Now, the good thing about birds is you don't have to remember that alphabet soup, really, because birds get all of the hemagglutinin and all of the neuraminidase types. Pick any combination of hemagglutinin and neuraminidase, and it has been isolated from a bird. Most of the bird viruses bind to the alpha-2-3 linkage, and birds have that receptor in the upper part of their respiratory tract. Now, so having said that all birds get all of the H and all of the N types, only two of them cause disease. Only the H5 and H7 are the ones that are going to make the birds sick. The rest of them, the birds just have the infection subclinically. And what we worry about the most, if we go to the next slide that says host range, what we worry about most are the waterfowl, because the waterfowl are really terribly promiscuous when it comes to these avian influenza viruses. They replicate them all. They replicate them well. And where do they replicate them? They replicate them in their intestinal tract, because the cells in the intestinal tract of waterfowl have the receptor that will bind just about any of the avian influenza viruses. And think about waterfowl. Now, what do? They go from one place to another, and they defecate everywhere. So we refer to them as indiscreet defecators. So as they go along the flyways, they are dropping avian influenza virus out their hind end. So, you know, I think Gary Larson really understands an awful lot about animal science and infectious disease. So I think of the duck as being this guy coming out of the men's room, because birds certainly are not very hygienic. On to the next slide, which is all about the highly pathogenic avian influenza strains. So, as I mentioned before, all birds get all of the H and N types, but only some of them will cause disease. Those that cause disease we call highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI. And these are the viruses that are regulated. Well, how do you determine if a specific avian influenza virus is HPAI and we need to worry about it? How do we do that? Well, there are two ways we do it. One is, and this seems like a no-brainer, if it's lethal after intravenous inoculation of chickens, then it's considered HPAI. But there's actually a specific test. It's called the IVPI, Intravenous Pathogenicity Index, where you take 10 chickens, give them all the same amount, and monitor the number of sick, number dead. You come up with a formula. So you actually get a number qualification. And if it's over a certain number, then it's called highly pathogenic avian influenza. The other criterion is to look at the amino acid sequence on the hemagglutinin. Now, remember a few slides ago, we talked about the hemagglutinin being responsible for attachment to the cell. That hemagglutinin can only attach to the cell and therefore get in if it gets cleaved first. So it's a big molecule. It has to split into two in order to bind. Well, the really bad avian influenzas can split in two very easily, and that's based on the amino acid sequence. Whereas those that don't cause disease can only be cleaved when there's an enzyme around, an enzyme like trypsin, which is found in the intestinal tract and in the digestive tract. So these mild viruses get in and replicate, but they can't go systemic because there's no trypsin out in the other organs. So they're just restricted to the respiratory tract or the intestinal tract. Well, let's look at what the disease looks like in chickens. Highly pathogenic avian influenza. This is a virus, I worked on this virus 20 years ago before we knew it was transmitted to humans. And I think about the number of necropsies that I did on sick chickens without any kind of personal protective equipment, and I think, you know, I'm glad I didn't know it was a zoonosis then. So some of these are pictures that I took. The clinical disease with highly pathogenic avian influenza. And on this slide, you should see two pictures of chickens. HPAI clinical disease is at the top of the slide. And you can see the chicken on the left. This chicken is sick. It's got a droopy head. Its comb is drooping. It has ruffled feathers. And we call this very depressed. Now, I sent an article off to a journal recently that is a human medical journal, human pathology journal, and I wrote about the chickens being depressed. The reviewer wrote back and said, how can you tell the chickens are depressed? I think depression for us in veterinary medicine has a different connotation than it does in human medicine. But anytime we see these ruffled feathers, we say that the bird is depressed. And of course, over on the right, that bird is down and just about dead. This virus, once it gets in and it gets in via the respiratory tract, these highly pathogenic avian influenza strains, they will kill a chicken within 72 hours. So it's a very short time course. They're very sick and then they're dead. Often the first thing you see is a dead chicken. There are times when you don't even recognize that it's ill. When this virus gets into a chicken house, and these chicken houses can hold 50,000 broilers, we see a picture like we saw in the previous slide, just the whole house is dead. And that's what raises the alarm and causes the veterinarians to call the state and federal officials who come in to control the disease so that it doesn't spread throughout the country. The next slide, which says HPAI, gross lesions, you know, I'm a pathologist, and I really can't understand a disease until I understand how the virus is moving through the body and what's happening. Well, this virus really likes endothelium of capillaries. So it replicates in the endothelium and then spreads out and causes leakiness, and it may spread out into the adjacent tissues as well. So here we have very characteristic features of highly pathogenic avian influenza. Hemorrhage on the shank of the leg. And on the right, there's a tremendous amount of edema in the jaw and the wattles. The wattles are those fleshy things that hang down beneath the beak. They're actually temperature regulator devices. And the endothelium in these areas gets very infected, and we see hemorrhage and edema, as I'll show you in the next slide. This slide has a big picture of a bird lung, and it's very wet and very red. There's been a tremendous amount of fluid leakage and hemorrhage because the capillaries within this organ have been damaged. On the lower right is an open trachea showing hemorrhage on the mucosal surface, once again because of the capillary damage. And the lower picture on the right shows all that edema in the subcutaneous region. The picture on the lower right is actually a picture I took in Afghanistan. I think Paul mentioned that I had done some work in Afghanistan. I was there when avian influenza entered the country. And so I did the postmortem on the first chicken that allowed for the diagnosis of avian influenza to be made. And I was in a postmortem room that has no biosafety cabinets, no good disposal, not very good ventilation, no electricity, and I was really glad I had on my N95 mask. And after that, I went on Tamiflu for 2 weeks, which is a nasty drug. But that diagnosis allowed them to get funding from the international community to control and eradicate the disease, which they did. The next slide, which is labeled Wattle, is immunohistochemistry. Now, I mentioned I'm a pathologist. These are from some studies we did. And just to very briefly tell you, on the upper right, at 2 days post-infection, all the virus is in little circles, just in the capillaries. And then at 4 days post-infection, on the lower right, it has burst out of the capillaries. We've got ruptured capillaries, and it's infecting the tissue around there. So you can see how we get a great buildup of hemorrhage or edema in many tissues. The next slide, which is heart, shows once again the staining at 2 days post-infection is very nice in those little capillary areas, nice delineated round areas, but by 4 days post-infection has burst out of the capillaries and is infecting the cardiac myocytes. This also happens in brain, happens in liver, happens in kidney. But when I see this picture in the heart, it makes me realize why in the 1918 pandemic, there would be people who didn't feel all that bad in the morning, would get on the streetcar to go to work, and drop dead. Because the virus moves out into these parenchymatous tissues and can severely and rapidly compromise a vital organ. So the next slide talks about transmission of highly pathogenic avian influenza. Body fluids, lots and lots of virus. Certainly, we already talked about the feces. Certainly, with ducks, that's true. Saliva will have a lot of virus. Fomites. Oh, my goodness. This disease has been taken from one place to another on rubber boots, people's hands, instruments. Big problem. Aerosols. Just like human influenza, highly pathogenic avian influenza is spread the same way among birds. And what we have as a picture in this slide, this is the air sac of a bird. Birds have an extra little sac to take in additional air as they breathe in, and the epithelium of the air sac is just loaded with virus, the red dots. So each time this bird exhales, lots of virus is going out into the environment. And waterfowl do not get sick with highly pathogenic avian influenza. You can have a virus that kills poultry, but the ducks are fine. That has always been true of highly pathogenic avian influenza until H5N1 came around. And H5N1, the bad strain that's circulating currently, also kills ducks. And maybe that's a good thing, because what do they say? Dead ducks don't fly. So the virus is less likely to be spread around. Influenza pandemics. What's the definition of a pandemic? It's a disease over a wide area, crossing international boundaries, often moving from one continent to another. And there are some people who say that this word pandemic should be reserved for influenza. And there are some others who say, no, any disease that moves around the world can be considered a pandemic. But when we talk about pandemics, often the first disease people think of is influenza, because the world has experienced some really awful episodes with influenza. Of course, the three most notable ones are the ones listed here. This so-called Spanish flu, H1N1, and remember we talked earlier about that virus first surfacing in pigs in the 1930s. It's probably the disease of humans that got into pigs and got adapted to pigs. This disease affected a quarter of the world's population and caused 40 million deaths worldwide. Some very recent work in reconstructing this virus and seeing what made it so lethal, it turns out that this particular H1N1, this virus will block the interferon response. So the body has no natural defense against virus invasion. You know, we're talking about influenza and possible pandemics, and I really like this picture on the upper right of Edward Munch, the scream. You know, I think when we talk about emerging diseases, this is often the gestalt we have. Well, on the lower right is another picture painted by Edward Munch, and this is self-portrait after a bout with influenza. And he has sunken eyes and really displays the decrepit condition that many people felt as they were recovering from that flu. We don't know where H1N1 came from. Nobody knows yet. So the two most recent pandemics were 1957 and 1968, and you can see the H and N types there. We know now that both of these viruses came from an avian precursor. Their avian virus is one of these non-pathogenic viruses that got into humans, became adapted, underwent selection, and became a pandemic strain. This H2N2 has completely disappeared from the world. We're not seeing it anywhere now. But H3N2 has adapted, and we are seeing that virus periodically. Why do pandemics happen? There has been a shift in the dogma in recent years about how they've happened. The basic premise is the same. That is that this virus has 8 different segments in it. And so as you get this, as you move this virus into a new species and it can possibly mix with another virus, you're likely to get 8 new segments or a new reassortment of segments. And you see here, I'm sorry, I should tell you, we're on the slide that says, how have pandemics happened? You can see here is a picture of the virus with the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase on the outside. Those are the cardinal features of the virus. That's how we label it. And each one of these viruses has 8 different segments of RNA. So it's not replicating in a line. Each of these segments is replicating, and if you get 2 different viruses in the same cell, they're going to go off. They could go off with other companions at the end of the replication. And that is demonstrated on the next slide in the figure on the lower right, how you can get 2 different viruses infecting the same cell, and you come out of it with a new virus. On the upper left, the larger diagram, we used to always say, well, we know that pigs have the receptor for human virus, and they have the receptor for avian virus, so the 2 of them get into a pig and mixing happens and a whole new virus comes out. That could happen. But in fact, we now know that the last 2 pandemics were just avian viruses and that there were no pig viruses, no pig virus genes in there. So the dogma has really changed. What we're worried about now is not so much the ducks and the pigs getting together. We're worried about now the people and the chickens being together. So on this next slide, the title says, can avian influenzas infect humans? Well, it's a complicated slide showing all of the different strains that have been isolated from human cases since we first found out that avian influenza could infect humans. So let's start over on the upper right where it says Hong Kong, 1997. In 1997, you may remember there were quite a few cases in humans. A little boy died, a 5-year-old boy died, and they decided that they really needed to isolate the virus because, you know, with influenza, they don't always isolate and type the virus. It's a bit of work. And when they did type that virus and it came out H5N1, the whole biomedical community sat up and said, what? Human viruses are 1, 2, and 3. 5 and 7 are supposed to occur in birds. What's happening? So they did the whole sequence, and they found, in fact, it was an avian virus that had gotten into people. So it's that same virus, H5N1. We thought we'd put a lid on it, but it continued to fester, and, of course, now it is in 3 continents and has caused 172 deaths. But let's look at some of the other viruses that have been isolated out of humans. We've got a couple here in North America. In 2002, 2003, we had H7N2 in turkeys in Virginia. We decided, although it was not causing bad disease in turkeys, we decided to eradicate it because they did the sequencing, and they said there only needs to be 1 mutation to turn this into a highly pathogenic avian influenza virus. So they went at it, and they did eradicate it, but during the period when it was circulating, 2 people seroconverted, but there was no illness. Then in British Columbia in 2004, they had to depopulate all of the chickens in British Columbia because H7N3 surfaced. It was highly pathogenic, and there were 2 people who seroconverted in British Columbia. So no deaths in the Americas. I think the only other one that I want to mention is the case in Hong Kong in 1999 over at the far right middle of the screen when there was a case of H9N2. Now, H9 is not a highly pathogenic virus, but it got not in chickens, but it got into a human and made the human sick. We're not doing much monitoring of H9 because it's not a problem in birds. Only H5 and H7 are problems in birds. So I think we need to maybe look at H9 a little bit more because that may be the virus that adapts to humans and causes the next pandemic. Okay. Next slide shows Time Magazine and the, well, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Is Asia hatching the next human pandemic? Well, this is a Time Magazine cover from February of 2004, almost 3 years ago, and we're still asking the same question. Will avian influenza, will this H5N1 turn out to be a massive plague that spreads all over the world? We still don't have the answer to that, but I hope that by the end of this talk, you will have a greater appreciation of what might happen and what our risks are. On to the next slide, which is also a cartoon. I believe it's a takeoff on Marvin the Martian, but I'm not sure. Bird flu, this H5N1. This is a very nasty strain of avian influenza that has infected a lot of people. The next slide is the most recent information from when I sent the PowerPoints out about the number of countries in the world that have reported H5N1 in birds. 55 countries have the presence of the virus. The most recent continent to be infected is Africa. And as I heard at one recent avian influenza conference, the virus H5N1 has found its Disneyland. If you think of the number of potential hosts that there are in Africa, this virus is going to have tremendous opportunity to circulate among wild animals and cause further problems. Then the next slide, also from the WHO website, is the number of human cases in the same time period. So although there have been 55 countries that have reported the presence of the virus in birds, 10 countries only have reported the presence of the virus in humans. And then the next slide are the cumulative number of confirmed cases. And I went on the internet just prior to dialing in. This figure has changed. As of the 22nd of January, it was 269 people infected. But there have been additional cases in Indonesia and Egypt, so that today that number is 272 people infected and 166 deaths. So this is a virus of concern because it is a disease of very high mortality, although the morbidity is quite low. Doing serologic studies of people who work around poultry, they're pretty certain that this is not just the tip of the iceberg, that if you are infected, you are going to get sick. There is very little to no evidence of seropositivity in people who are not clinically ill or who have not been clinically ill. So this virus is circulating in Southeast Asia, and a couple of years ago we got worried because we're on the next slide now, which says other species infected with H5N1. There were more than 150 tigers in Thailand alone that died with clinical signs and pathologic features consistent with H5N1. And they did isolate the virus from these animals. The way most of them got it is that as they were going through with the eradication campaign, they were killing large numbers of chickens. They wanted to do something with the chickens, so they gave them to the large cats at zoos to eat. So we're not entirely sure how many of these cats, these large cats, got the disease from eating the poultry, or once they became sick, then passing it from one to another via contact. At about the same time, there were anecdotal reports of cats on some of the poultry farms in Southeast Asia succumbing to avian influenza. So some researchers in the Netherlands, and we're on the next page now that's titled Feline Friend or Potential Foe, some researchers in the Netherlands decided, well, we need to do the experiment to find out if cats can be infected. So they got some chicks, one-day-old chicks, infected them with H5N1. A day later, so it allows the virus a little time to replicate, a day later fed the chicks to the cats. The cats became sick and died with a disease that looked very much like the disease in chickens or in humans. Well, so it looks like they can be experimentally infected. How about transmission? Can it go from cat to cat? Because that would raise the ante a little bit in terms of what are the risks of having a cat around. So they did the same thing. Gave day-old chicks avian influenza virus, gave the chicks to the cat. Cats got sick, then they put some clean cats in with the sick cats, and the clean cats also came down with avian influenza. So it appears that they're not only able to be naturally infected, but that the infection spreads cat to cat. And we had never recorded influenza virus in cats before, ever. So this virus really appears to have a fairly wide host range. Then on the next slide, which is the same group that did the cat experiment I just described, actually infected cats and then followed the course of the disease through the body. And what I would like to point out to you is on the left side where it says kidney. And if you look over on there's an H&E of the kidney, and then there's an immunohistochemistry picture of the kidney. You see all that red in the kidney. All of that is virus. And where does that virus go? The virus goes into the urine. So this virus may be spread not only by exhalation, but it also might be spread through the urine, which is of concern. The next slide. What about other species infected with H5N1? We have seen it in a couple of dogs. This one this particular article documents a case in Thailand, but there was also a case of a dog in Azerbaijan. They appear to be less susceptible, and the two dogs that have been reported as picking up the disease have gotten it from eating wild birds that have died of the disease. On to the next slide, other species infected with H5N1. So we see the waterfowl, the geese, the chickens, the dead chickens, and most of the people who've gotten the disease have gotten it from being around chickens. There is one report of a person who came down with highly pathogenic avian with H5N1 as a result of picking up feathers from wild birds that have died. But so far, all of the cases in humans have been due to exposure to chickens. Pigs seem to be playing a very minor role. Something like 0.2% of all of the pigs that are in contact with infected chickens are serologically positive. They're not ill, and there does not seem to be any pig-to-pig transmission. Okay, on to the next slide, which says next pandemic. Some of you may remember the ABC movie last year, Fatal Contact, Bird Flu in America, starring Jolie Richardson, who is Vanessa Redgrave's daughter. And she was the MD in charge of what happens when avian influenza, when the H5N1 became transmissible human to human. Now, I think part of this movie had a tendency to spark mass hysteria, but some positive aspects as well. You know, whenever the layperson sees this kind of information, that's when they always have questions. And this is an opportunity, really, it's our teachable moment to help spread accurate information and usable information about the disease. But for those of you who saw it, you may remember that Jolie Richardson, she's the MD epidemiologist. Well, I'm not sure what she is, because in the beginning she's a consultant to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and then she's a field epidemiologist going over to Africa, and then she's a primary care physician at the emergency room. Oh, she's also a pathologist. She does the autopsy on someone who dies, and she's in the lab working on molecular virology as well. So maybe we can help to educate people that, you know, that's more than an overachiever could accomplish. Actually, my mother saw this movie, and she called me up, and she accused me of being an underachiever. Okay. Yes, what the general public knows about science, we can always help them, can't we? So what is it that causes humans to get this H5N1 virus? In the earlier part of this talk, we mentioned about the binding to the receptors. The avian influenza viruses, they bind to, well, the birds have the alpha-2-3, sialic acid linked to alpha-2-3, linked via alpha-2-3 linkage to galactose throughout their respiratory tract, especially the upper respiratory tract, also throughout the gut. Well, humans don't have alpha-2-3. At least they don't have it in their upper respiratory tract. What humans have are alpha-2-6. And the human viruses bind to alpha-2-6. So how is it that these bird viruses are getting into humans? Some very elegant work within the last year shows that humans do, in fact, have the 2-3 linkage. So look at this picture with the two people sleeping with a group of chickens. And imagine that all of these chickens are sick with H5N1. It's replicating in their upper respiratory tract, it's in their fecal secretions, it's in their saliva, and the air is just loaded with H5N1. Then these humans who are right there are breathing this in. But they don't have the receptor that will allow them to get infected. At least they don't have the receptor in their upper respiratory tract. Now, if you look at the number of humans that have been infected, although we've had millions of birds that have been infected, only 272 people have been infected with the same virus. Why is that? Well, we look on the next slide, which has some fluorescent antibody pictures on it. It's an article in which the lead investigator is Yoshi Kawoka, who is a veterinary virologist at the University of Wisconsin. And he has shown very elegantly that, in fact, humans do have the alpha-2-3 receptor. But look where it is. If you look at the top three pictures, you can see that all the surface areas are green. The upper respiratory tract has only alpha-2-6. But then if you go down to look at the picture on the lower left and the lower right, you'll see lots of red spots. So in fact, humans have alpha-2-3 receptors deep in their lungs. So if you think back to that picture where we have the two humans in close proximity to all the chickens, if there's enough virus in the air, the volume getting in could actually get down into the alveoli. And that's where it binds and replicates, gets disseminated. Now, it's not going to spread human to human unless there's a tremendous amount of sneezing or some other aspect that allows for large amounts of virus to be in the air. So this is why humans are only getting it from being around chickens that have the disease. Where are the chickens that have the diseases? Well, we saw, and is there likely to be disease? Yes, I think there will. Are we going to have a big disease? Well, you know, if it's not avian influenza, it's going to be something else. So all of this preparedness for pandemic influenza will help us. Or we could just get a lot of worry beads. I took this picture in Kuwait of a worry bead store. Next slide, control of in poultry is essential. The virus is going to evolve. In order for the virus to be spread from human to human, it's going to have to evolve, that something's going to have to change in its receptor sensitivity. The more virus that's allowed to replicate, the greater chance that this is going to happen. Remember, mutations are random. So you get a huge house full of poultry all infected with this virus. We're talking about a gazillion viruses, and they are all going to be undergoing mutation. Whether or not that mutation is actually one that will allow its survival in humans, we don't know unless we put humans in there. So what I'm trying to say is that the virus is going to evolve. Mutations are random, but selection is not. So what we want to do is we want to decrease the amount of the disease in poultry to cut down on that huge amplification pressure, and then for those humans who are associated with the poultry to make sure that they use good personal protection. And you see here a picture of an N95 mask, which will help people from getting infected. But it's not just the poultry. Live bird markets. I visited a live bird market in the Middle East, and here we have an example of all of these different kinds of bird species together. As the virus gets into a new species, there is going to be selection pressure. We're likely to see more rapid evolution. And in many of these live bird markets, which are not just in other parts of the world, we have 183 live bird markets in New York City alone. And in many of these markets, certainly in other countries, we have the birds associated not just with other birds, all kinds of species, but also with, as you can see from this picture, rabbits and cats. So we have mammalian hosts there as well. What we need is really good biosecurity for these facilities, and good awareness among the people who maintain the facilities. Now, I know a lot of people, we're on to the next slide now, which is role of migratory birds. I know many people have talked about this migratory birds that are going to bring it into an area, and we have to be careful about all the migratory birds. It is true that migratory birds can bring the disease into an area. They can be incubating it, flying it, shedding it as they're flying, but it will kill most of the migratory birds, so that's a good thing about H5N1. And it has brought the disease into some areas, especially in Europe, but then once the disease is in an area, it's moved around by another species, namely Homo sapiens, who are moving the poultry around. So although it may be responsible for an introduction, it's not responsible for big outbreaks. And if you look at the diagram of the major flyways of migratory birds, you will see in Alaska there's an overlap between the North American flyway and the Southeast Asian flyway. That's where the wildlife people and the agricultural people and the public health people are concentrating all of their surveillance efforts. They're looking at hundreds of thousands of birds in Alaska to try and see if H5N1 is coming in. The good news is that other strains have not mixed in that area. And on the right, we see the first case of bird flu in Florida. On to the next slide, vaccination. And we're very close to the end here. Could we vaccinate? Well, a vaccine for humans is under development. There's a lot of people who are working to get this going. But as I mentioned earlier, controlling the disease in poultry is really what we need to keep the disease from spreading to humans. This is Ilaria Capua, an Italian scientist who has been a big proponent of sharing sequences, of countries being transparent about where the disease is. And she has a strategy called DIVA, differentiating infected from vaccinated animals. And what this involves is if you want to see if H5N1 is out there, you don't want to vaccinate your birds with H5N1 because then you can never do zero surveillance. So she's a proponent of making vaccines for something like H5N3, which will prevent infection, but then you can go back and do zero surveillance and determine that it hasn't been there. And vaccines are available for poultry. The next to last slide is about antivirals. There are a few antivirals which are good against the influenza viruses. The one that is used predominantly is Tamiflu, and this inhibits the neuraminidase, so it can get into the cell, but it can't get out. We used to use a lot of amantadine or remantadine, but the H5N1 has become resistant to that category of drugs, largely because it was used in some countries in Asia to protect chickens. And so the H5N1 virus has adapted so that it is resistant to those. And to the last slide, which is really about the end and the future. I think it was Yogi Berra who said, it ain't over till it's over. He also said something that is very applicable for influenza pandemics, that is, the future ain't what it used to be. We really are presented with another whole set of criteria to think about when it comes to infectious diseases. And I really do think it's true that global is local. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brown. I think any teleclass that gets a Yogi Berra quote in is a good teleclass. That, in fact, your third teleclass in 3 years. You really just keep getting better. I can't wait to hear what you have to say in 2008. Dr. Brown, you mentioned that you returned recently from Afghanistan, where you helped to diagnose the country's first case of bird flu. One of the things that intrigued me when I was reading about this, a quote from you, that you said that you saw the human-animal bond in a completely new way. What did you mean by that?
In veterinary medicine, we tend to think of the human-animal bond as the good feelings that we have for our companion animals, for our pets. We tend to treat, here in North America, we tend to treat our pets as members of the family, and we're willing to spend a lot of money to keep them healthy. However, in Afghanistan, a place where they don't have pets, everybody has a chicken in their backyard, a chicken or a group of chickens, and these chickens lay eggs. The children in the family will collect the eggs, take them down to the corner, try and sell them. They will kill a chicken when it's time to put a little bit of protein into their diet. And to me, it's a human-animal bond related to survival, and I found that very touching.
where do you see your work going in Afghanistan and in that region of Europe?
I'm working with people to help improve their diagnostic capabilities and the animal health infrastructure. So I'm working to train veterinarians to do necropsies, autopsies on animals that have died to help them get a better handle on what kind of diseases they have in the country so that they can implement efficient control programs.
The great debate that I've heard over and over again, panicking obviously is not something that's good, but a lot of people are preparing and are proponents of preparation. That's a difficult thing to say. But there's a contrarian view that it's unlikely that all of the expense and all of the effort we're going through to prepare for an influenza pandemic may be out of place and may be overblown. What's your view on that?
That's a great question, and we saw the same thing with bioterror 6 years ago, bioterror,
yes.
And now we're seeing it with avian influenza. And that's partially true, but I think the larger truth is that all of this is giving us an infusion of an idea about how to work together, how to get the funds to prepare for whatever Mother Nature is going to dole out next.
Well, that's a very diplomatic answer. I won't push you. Thank you very much. So thanks to everyone for joining this teleclass. Special thanks to Dr. Corey Brown for another outstanding lecture. Until we meet again, everyone, make sure to move those chickens and pigs out of your bedroom, and we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you.